Today's reading is Matthew chapter 26, verses 31 to 45, reading from the ESV Bible. Matthew chapter 26, verses 31 to 45. Then Jesus said to them, "You will all fall away because of me this night, for it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered.' But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee." Peter answered him, "Though they all fall away because of you, I will never fall away." Jesus said to him, "Truly I tell you, this very night, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." Peter said to him, "Even if I must die with you, I will not deny you." And all the disciples said the same. Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." And taking with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me." Going a little farther, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, "My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." And he came to the disciples and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, "So could you not watch with me this 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." Again for the second time he went away and prayed, "My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done." And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So, leaving them again, he went away and prayed for the third time, saying the same words again. Then he came to the disciples and said to them, "Sleep and take your rest later on. See, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners." This is the word of the Lord.
Good morning. And welcome once more to this small corner of my study. I haven't been here for a while, so it's great to be back with you once more, although I'm sad that we're not able to meet face to face. As many of you will know, I was able to have a great holiday in Greece, where we try to go each year. And whilst I was there, I had plenty of time to think and to take stock, to try and understand this time of trial, this time of testing, which we are all enduring. Not only us, of course, but the whole church. And the great trial is that of simply not being able to meet, not being able to see each other face to face. And this is not, of course, how the church should be. Sadly, many do not understand this. Many seem to think that meeting virtually, even meeting virtually with other churches many miles away online, is just as good, if not better, than meeting locally. No doubt other churches online in the UK and in the United States of America and elsewhere, to put it bluntly, are better churches. They may be bigger with charismatic leaders and professional musicians, but they're not local. They are not present. They are disembodied. And this is not healthy in the long term. It's not healthy for us either in the long term to meet virtually. And the reason for this is because it is rooted and linked to the way that Jesus came into the world. When Jesus came to found his church, he did not come virtually. He did not appear as some distant apparition on a computer screen in the sky. He came as flesh and blood. He spoke to people face to face. he said to Thomas, put your fingers in my side where the spear was thrust, put your fingers in my hands where the nails were placed. And so Jesus came to us in person. He came embodied. And so he touched the dead. He touched lepers. He touched people's eyes. And he held their hands. And people touched him. They touched his feet. And they ran to meet him and hold on to him. And ever since then, the church has always sought to meet in time and in space and in a place where we hear the word being preached, and also we see it being preached. One of the great frustrations I have is speaking to an empty room, looking at a small screen. I know my words will land somewhere out there at some point, but I can't see the impact. I can't immediately respond to its effect. And so whilst we should be very thankful that we can still master technology to meet remotely, we should appreciate that we are meeting remotely. We are meeting on Zoom. We are singing on YouTube. We are not together as a body occupying a physical space. And so we can't take hold of Christ's sacramental body and blood. And this is not how the church should be. This is not how the church is meant to be. And we are undergoing trying times. This is part of the testing we are enduring. We are being sifted. And deep down, I think we know this. The other day, someone said to me, I feel disconnected from everyone and everything. And I thought, yes, that's it. I feel as if there's a kind of blanket between me and the world. And I'm reminded of that haunting, despairing song that Pink Floyd once sang when they chanted, "Is there anybody out there?" Which is where we find Jesus in Matthew chapter 26, the lesson that was read this morning. Because in our reading today, Jesus looks and searches and there is nobody there. He says to his disciples, couldn't you men keep watch with me? But they couldn't. They were absent. They were not present. Peter, James and John were asleep, which stands in marked contrast to what we heard last week. Remember last week when Wallace Benn was reminding us of Peter's great declaration in Caesarea Philippi, where Peter declared in ringing tones that Jesus was the Christ, the Son of the living God, that he was the anointed Messiah sent to save men and women from death and hell and everlasting torment. And what was so amazing about that occasion was that Peter made that proclamation in the very heart of a pagan city. A city dedicated to idolatrous kings. A city dedicated to both Caesar and Philip. It was Caesarea Philippi, after all. A city in which there was a cave that was thought to be the entrance to the underworld and the place where the god Pan lived. A god who created pandemonium. And who was depicted as a lustful half-goat, half-man. He was a wild god, the god of shepherds and breeding flocks. And it was in that pagan city that Peter suddenly saw who Jesus was, that he was who he claimed to be. And right then and right there, in the heart of a fetishistic city devoted to Pan, Jesus said, on the basis of that truth, that I am the Messiah, the Son of God, I am going to build my church. And with that truth, with that word of truth, with that sword of truth, I'm going to lay siege to hell itself, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. For just as a strong man, Samson, ripped off the gates of the pagan city of Gaza and carried them off on his shoulders, leaving the city exposed. So I shall rip off the gates of hell and lay waste to the kingdom of death. And Peter and all the others were with Jesus at that time. They were face to face with him, and no sooner had Jesus said that hell could not prevail against his church, he began to speak of his death. There is going to go to Gethsemane. There is going to the place of the olive press, which is what Gethsemane means. That he was, as it were, going to be crushed between two millstones. That he was going to be poured out unto death, poured out like olive oil leaching through the stones, poured out like water. That all his bones were going to be disjointed, that his strength was going to dry up like a piece of pottery, that he was going to be laid in the dust of death. And Jesus knew all this, of course, because he knew the Old Testament that spoke of all these things. That he was going to walk along the Via Dolorosa. That he was going to walk through the valley of the shadow of death. But no sooner had Jesus said that he was going to suffer many things and be killed, no sooner had he said that Peter said, "No, no, 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 no. Anointed messiahs do not go through suffering and death. That is foolishness. It is foolishness to all concerned, to both Greek and Jew." And so Peter began to crow. He began to say, "I will never leave you. I will always be present with you. I will always be there for you, Jesus. I will be with you. I will never deny you." And in our reading today, Jesus said, "This very night, before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times," which means you are crowing now, Peter, but soon a real cockerel will crow. And when it crows, you will have already denied me three times, because I have to go to Gethsemane to fulfill the scriptures. And you think, why? Why does Jesus have to go to the Garden of Gethsemane to fulfill the scriptures? What does that mean? I'm glad you asked that question, because it's the right question to ask. For you see, in the Bible, the garden is always a place where God meets his people. For the garden symbolizes harmony, peace, and unity between God and man. It represents what the Jews call shalom. And so it is that when you open the Bible, you find yourself in a garden, the Garden of Eden, a garden in which men and women walked with God and talked with God in the cool of the day. For God had planned it that way. He had made it that way. He had planned and intended to be forever the friend of men and women, because we were created in his image and everything had been provided. But then men and women fell. They said to God, "We do not want you to rule over us. We want what we would call a safe space from you. You watcher of men, you voyeur." That's what Jean-Paul Sartre said. He said, "Hell is being watched all the time by God, who never takes his eyes off you. He is, as it were, a cosmic voyeur who looks deep into you, who leaves you no space, who stifles you, who induces claustrophobia." But although Sartre said that in the middle of the 20th century, Adam and Eve said it first. They said to God, "Go away." So God said, "Your will be done." And they were expelled out of the garden into the wilderness. They were thrown out into the wasteland. But from that moment on, God begins to work to win men and women back into the garden, back into fellowship. And he says, I will lead you beside still waters. I will restore your soul. And the prophet Ezekiel said that God will one day bring his people from a land laid waste to a garden, back to a garden like Eden, a garden where fruit trees of all kinds will grow on both sides of the riverbank. Their leaves, said Ezekiel, shall not wither, nor will their fruit fail. Every month they'll bear abundant fruit, because the water from the temple of God will flow out to them. Their fruit will serve for food and their leaves for healing. And at the end of the Bible, John takes up that vision and he says that's what heaven is going to be like. That's where God is one day going to bring his church. For Jesus Christ will one day burst out of heaven on a war horse and sweep up his bride and bring her home. And so John says that in heaven, the river of the water of life, as clear as crystal, will flow from the throne of God, and on each side of the river will stand the tree of life, endlessly fruitful, yielding its fruit every month, which will soothe the nations of the world. But between the Garden of Eden and between the garden spoken of by Ezekiel and John lies the Garden of Gethsemane. And Jesus had to go there. For in order to restore mankind to fellowship with God, Jesus had to pass through the olive press. He had to endure the punishment that the first Adam's sin had visited upon the world. And so Jesus comes as a second Adam, and the Garden of Eden acts as the Garden of Gethsemane acts as a reverse Eden. In the first Eden, Adam forsook God, and God had to evict him from the garden, for fellowship had been broken. In Gethsemane, God forsook the God-man, the second Adam, and man in the form of an unbelieving mob, evicted Jesus the Messiah from the garden. So if God evicted man from the Garden of Eden, here men evict God from the Garden of Gethsemane. They threw him out to be pressed between two millstones. The upper millstone was the millstone of God's wrath against sin, and the lower millstone was the millstone of the hatred of men and women who loved the pagan kings of Caesar and Philip more than they loved him. And it had to be that way. The Messiah had to die. It was the will of the Father, so that through his eviction from the garden, Jesus could bring us who are united to him by faith to the greater, more glorious and better garden of heaven. Did you notice how Matthew also gives us a glimpse of this? For when Jesus rises from the dead, he rises from the dead in a garden, in a place of fertility, where he is mistaken for a gardener. I need to close. What can we learn from all this? Well, I think there's one massive lesson for us all. The church in this world is a church that is being constantly tested and relentlessly sifted. We are, as it were, in a garden of Gethsemane, a time of difficulty. We are, as it were, a church scattered among the nations of the world. And today, the church is not only scattered among the nations of the world, we're also separated from each other in a new way, where meeting is difficult and restricted and possibly dangerous. And so we are in a great danger of falling away, of growing weary, of simply giving up meeting together, as the writer of the Hebrews warned us we will be tempted to do. But you see, we must remember and remind each other that although we are all dispersed, we will one day be gathered back together. On that terrible night in the Garden of Gethsemane, the disciples ran away from Jesus, but he brought them back together again. He reconstituted them in Galilee and sent them out to preach the gospel throughout the world. And then he gathered them to be with him once more in heaven. And he will do the same for us. He will do the same to all of us who love him and want to be with him forever in glory. I pray constantly that this one day soon, will be your experience as well. That we will know that being united to Christ, there will come a day where we are all joined together around his throne in heaven. Let's work for that day. Let that day that is in front of us give us hope in the presence, in the present, and let us joyfully respond in faith to Jesus, our Messiah, the Anointed One, the Son of God. Amen. And may God bless each and every one of you.